As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And on the day we're recording this, I just got back from a vacation while I was out. Robert, you've been busy. You had a chat with quite a few people.
Yeah, I decided to log a few interviews since I couldn't sit here and chat with you. I happen to be in a yoga boot camp right now.
Yeah.
Where I'm going 3 days a week and doing yoga at a ridiculous hour of the morning.
Mm.
Like really, really intense, sweaty yoga. So I've been thinking about yoga a lot, and I was like, well, if I can't talk to Joe, I'm going to talk to somebody about yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So I called up Ann Swanson of Ann Swanson Wellness. She's the author of Science of Yoga, Understand the Anatomy and Physiology to Perfect Your Practice. And this is good. This is just me chatting with Ann about yoga, about what yoga is, what yoga isn't, what happens when science and spirituality come together and occasionally like butt heads in yogic practices, and also what the research is telling us and what it's not telling us about yoga and its benefits to our mind, to our body, to the mind-body connection.
Awesome. Well, I am really excited to hear this one. I'm sure the listeners out there, you folks are too. So maybe we should dive right in. Let's get in that pose.
Hi, Ann. Welcome to the show. Can you just introduce yourself to our audience here?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad to be here, Robert. My name is Ann Swanson, and I am a total science nerd and spiritual nerd. I'm also a yoga therapist and meditation teacher by trade. I have a master's of science in yoga therapy. I'm an IAYT certified yoga therapist, and I studied yoga in India, where it is from. I am also a science educator. So I teach people about the real science supporting yoga. So I take out the woo factor of yoga that intimidates a lot of people, but I still strongly believe in respecting the rich tradition of this ancient practice that has really stood the test of time.
So we're going to be talking about yoga in this this interview. So, but before we get going, I thought I might ask you to just stop and just answer the question, especially for people who are maybe not that familiar with it. What is yoga?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think it's not what most people think it is. Most people see these billboards and covers of magazines, and they think it's thin people doing pretzel-like poses. Mm-hmm. But really, you don't have to be thin and flexible to do yoga. And the poses are only a small part of this practice. So like that's the part that made it popular and famous, but really there's so much more. So there's the poses is the first part, but also we have breath work, controlled breathing practices for a specific physiological result. We have focus exercises that train your brain, meditation, and a rich philosophical underpinning that you can study that integrates into your lifestyle. So a lot of people describe yoga as an entire lifestyle. And the word yoga loosely means union. So really it's about feeling connected to ourselves, united to others and the world, and feeling this greater sense of like compassion. Ultimately, these practices, they build space in your mind and in your body for compassion.
Yeah, I feel like the sort of the billboard idea of yoga, like for me, when I first started doing yoga, that was something that thankfully got to erode away pretty quickly when I went to a YMCA yoga class, and I got to experience it, amid, different age levels, different ability levels, different, body types. And realize that the sort of stereotypical billboard version of yoga was not going to be what I was going to experience.
Absolutely, and I think one of the things from a scientific perspective is that the research on yoga is not on how to have a bikini body, mm-hmm. or how to bend like a pretzel. Really, the research on yoga is on therapeutic populations. So people like older adults, people that are obese with diabetes, with heart disease, with breathing issues. These are the people that are getting the most benefits from the practice of yoga. And that's what the research is showing. So I hope that the image of yoga starts to change, because the people that can benefit most are regular folks with anxiety, with stress, with the common issues that we deal with in the modern day.
And we're going to get into some of the details of this here in a bit, but I do want to go ahead and highlight your book. You're the author of the 2019 book, Science of Yoga, Understand the Anatomy and Physiology to Perfect Your Practice. Naturally, there are a lot of yoga books out there, as anyone who's ever done a search on Amazon or browsed through the bookstore can attest to. What sets this one apart?
Yeah, I would say that this is not the typical how-to yoga book. Really, I describe it as a how it works yoga book. It's for those curious people who are going to yoga classes and constantly asking why. Why is this pose affecting my kidneys or squeezing out my toxins? Or even why do I feel so relaxed and sleep so much better after class? So I debunk a lot of those woo myths. And also I worked with a world-class illustration team to not only tell you why, but to show you why.
Yeah, I have to say that the layout and the illustrations in this book are just really gorgeous. It's very readable, very browsable, very consumable, and I love the way that it's divided up too. So beginning with just sort of an overview of human anatomy, what are the different parts and systems of the body, before going into the asanas, the poses, and discussing how those affect those systems. And then you have this very robust Q&A section at the end where you also engage in some myth busting as well, but also just discuss some of the scientific studies out there and what they're saying and what they're not saying in some cases.
Yeah, it's really great for visual learners, but also for those kinesthetic learners, like people that are body-based learners that have to move, because you can look at the picture and I think it invites you to actually move and see, is that the effect I'm feeling? Can I visualize my muscles, my organs working in that pose? So I hope it appeals to both of those audiences. Another big difference between my book and so many other yoga books is that I'm not just talking about the muscles and bones. So I am talking about all the systems of the body and the benefits of yoga. So from studying Western science myself, from doing pre-med course load and then earning my Master of Science in yoga therapy, I have basically had 10 years of tedious notes in my notebooks that was about how our body is affected through these stress management practices. And I compiled those to be in the most simple format, digestible format of the top benefits. And I cover all the systems of the body, because those most profound benefits are to the cardiovascular system, which is showing that we can reduce blood pressure and reverse heart disease with a yogic lifestyle, or the immune system, reducing inflammatory markers called cytokines, which are really important because most of the major killers that our society suffers from have to do with inflammation. And then, oh my gosh, the effects on your brain are so amazing. We could have an entire show on that itself. So I think it's important to emphasize how yoga affects all the systems of the body, not just that gross level.
Yeah, I love how throughout the book you keep coming back to the mind-body connection. And in some cases, we discuss the mind-body connection on this show a lot because, I think that's been one of the real take-homes from a lot of research over the past several decades, is that we realize that we're not just this brain in a body. We're not this rider on a horse. We're this integrated system, and all of our mental processes are not just dependent on things that are bottled in there. But there are even some poses, some systems you're discussing. You bring in the mind portion of the equation. So sometimes in cases where I'd never thought about it before, I tend to just focus on what this muscle is doing or what this muscle seems to be doing, and I'm not thinking about my mental state.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are a integrated whole. And the thing about yoga that makes it so magical, that makes it work so well, is that it is a whole person approach to well-being. So therapeutic yoga looks at the entire person, and yes, we move because there's profound benefits to movement and exercise. But we're also being aware of that movement, being mindful and present, feeling the vibrations of your 37 trillion cells or more in your body. You're acknowledging that life, that aliveness that you have. And I think it's important that we acknowledge the whole person, the emotional being, the person that has stressors, the person that has triggers and issues that are stored in their tissues. So I think that's one of the great strengths of yoga, is that it has that whole person approach.
I wanted to touch on research for a second here. You cite a number of studies in the book, especially towards the end in the Q&A section, and you also you do have a wonderful bit here too, where you're talking about how to tell if a particular study is reliable, and discussing things like sample size and the use of a control group, some things that folks who are used to maybe teasing apart a scientific study might be aware of, but others not so much. In general, though, taking in all of this scientific research, how much research is there into yoga?
Well, compared to pharmaceuticals, we don't have the same level of funding. So that is an issue. However, there has been an exponential growth of yoga research in the past decade, 20 years. So there is a decent amount of research in certain categories. So areas like mental health, that would be the top area, along with chronic pain. There's a lot of research. When we talk about yoga research, we're also talking about meditation research. So that's both of those categories have a lot for depression, anxiety, PTSD, along with chronic pain. And another area of research that is growing is for cardiovascular health and for other chronic pain conditions like arthritis and things that affect our daily life with disabilities. So those areas are absolutely growing because the research is promising. And I do want to say one reason I put that hierarchy of evidence in the book is because I feel like there is a lack of research literacy in the yoga community and the yoga teacher community, but also enthusiastic yogis. And I don't think that they want to be spreading kind of woo-woo claims. I think they really want to be telling people about the profound benefits. They just don't know how. And so if we can start to be critical about how we come about explaining the claims, the benefits, the warnings of the yoga poses and practices that we teach as yoga teachers, I think that's going to benefit the practice overall, making it more accepted in the mainstream by medical professionals, making it more accessible to those who can really benefit the most. Because when I'm in a yoga class and they say a claim like this is stimulating your kidneys. And they go on about that. I'm in my head. Mm-hmm. I'm out of my body and I'm in my head. And I know that the doctor and the nurse next to me are too. So if we can, as yoga teachers, as yoga professionals, actually spread actual true claims, I think that's going to make a big difference.
It is fascinating to think about yoga and the sort of opposing ideas that are sometimes present there. You have something that has ancient roots, and yet so much of it is actually quite modern. A particular class or teacher might invoke, to your point, both modern health and science, but also perhaps some elements of Hinduism or New Age spiritualism. So I guess it's kind of a challenge to sort of balance all of that, right? I mean, you mentioned that you're both a science nerd and a spiritualism nerd, and like to what extent do you sort of have to have sort of two views of the yoga and have to sort of switch from one to the other during a practice?
Yeah, I don't think we should deny that yoga has its roots in India alongside Hinduism. Mm-hmm. But the brilliant things about the practice can be adapted to the modern day, to the culture, to the individual and their beliefs. So, for example, if you're not religious at all, you can have a completely secular yoga practice and have the profound benefits, have the brain changes and the physiological health benefits. Or if you're religious, you can incorporate prayer. Like, I'm working with a Catholic woman right now, and she's doing her meditative practices with a rosary. So I think it's okay to adapt it, because ultimately, if you are becoming a healthier and more peaceful and connected human being, then that's a good thing for the world. However, what does bother me, where I do have a bone to pick, is when teachers and yoga professionals don't fess up to their modern adaptations of mixing these modalities. So, for example, let me use my example of the kidneys. I feel like I hear that a lot from teachers that have a Chinese medicine base. They're saying this is affecting your kidneys. Well, scientifically, we can't claim that your kidneys are being affected from some stretch or another. There's no research supporting that. It doesn't even really make sense with my understanding of anatomy and physiology. I mean, all your organs are benefited from a yoga practice in general, but we can't say that it's this particular pose versus that particular pose is affecting this organ for the most part. But I think that what could be done is, rather than just saying this is affecting your kidneys, which is confusing people, is say something like, well, according to Chinese medicine, this would affect your kidney meridian, right? Like, mm-hmm. Then you're actually describing the source of it, so that the people aren't thinking, well, actually our modern day conception of the kidney in the West is being affected. I think that that's where it gets confusing, and where it could be a little clearer, and why we should, as yoga practitioners, constantly ask why. Wait, why? What do you mean? Oh, you mean the kidney meridian. I got it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess, with the body, we're sometimes engaging with metaphorical or semi-metaphorical sort of spiritual models for what our bodies are doing and how we're experiencing our bodies and our mind. So you're saying it's sort of a good idea to be able to state like which model we're dealing with for a particular claim, right?
I think so. Like where you got it from, be able to know where you got it from. That's just a basic, also back to that scientific literacy, is like, where did I hear that from?
Right.
Can I look it up and confirm it? Because our memories will start to fade and change things over time.
Oh, absolutely. Another thing that comes up here, we spoke with a researcher on the show in the past whose focus was mindfulness, and they brought up how to study meditation in some of these studies they were conducting. You know, obviously they stripped away some of the more spiritual aspects of the meditative practices. I think they were looking at Tibetan models, and then they're stripping away any spiritualism from that. But then also even removing the word meditation from it, to referring it to something else during the study, so as not to ignite any biases among the participants. But then they acknowledge that, is there a risk there in removing some of the ideas, the spiritual ideas, not to, say that there is, some sort of magical practice going on here, but if we remove sort of the spiritual fluff from the mechanics of something, that it perhaps we're taking away something that helps it work. Do you ever think that might be the case with some of these yogic practices?
You know, from my experience of reading research, a lot of yoga researchers are not stripping away that essence, that profound part of it. And so with meditation and with yoga, so I'll give it as a two-part answer. So with meditation, a lot of the researchers themselves are meditators. So they want to maintain the essence of the practice. So let me give you an example. There is a study that's my favorite study of meditation of all time. It's at Wake Forest School of Medicine, and they had four different groups. One group was a mindfulness meditation group. They were taught mindfulness meditation by an experienced expert. They were taught the process, a little bit of the history, and guided through a traditional practice. Now, and this particular research study was evaluating pain. So they gave them a little shock in their leg before they learned meditation, before they got the treatment, and then after they were getting the treatment. Another group got a placebo cream. So they didn't learn any meditation or any processes, but instead they got a cream. They said, this is going to really help. It has an analgesic effect, even though it didn't. The third group got the control of listening to a book, like not even related. That was the control group. Now, the fourth group is my favorite. The fourth group got sham meditation. Yes, you heard that right. Fake meditation. So instead of being taught the traditional mindfulness techniques as the first group got, they were here. Let's do it together. You can do it at home if you're listening too. Okay. So sit tall. Imagine you're in a group of people. You're sitting on the floor in a circle. Okay, I am the instructor, and I'm saying, all right, everybody, take a deep breath. We are sitting here, and we are meditating. Keep breathing. Keep meditating. That's it. So what they found was pretty amazing. All the groups improved except the control. The book listening did nothing. Mm-hmm. But the sham meditation, the placebo cream, and the mindfulness meditation group, they all improved. But the mindfulness group significantly reduced pain compared to the others. That's pretty powerful. And I think that researchers really do care about keeping that essence of the practice in. Now, I'd like to talk about a yoga example if I can.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I also used to think that about yoga. Well, if we do research on yoga, then we're going to lose that essence, lose that whole person approach to well-being. So a 7-year clinical trial, a randomized controlled trial on yoga for arthritis at Johns Hopkins University, by Dr. Munaz, showed significant improvements in arthritis symptoms, including reduced joint swelling as measured by rheumatologists, which is a very objective measure, improved health-related quality of life, which is this like broad measure, but it is a validated instrument that shows that overall quality of life improved from doing yoga. And also, the huge finding is that pain was reduced by about 30%, which is significant. That's similar to what many pharmaceuticals do. So this particular trial by Dr. Munaz was not just, 10 poses to help you with your knee arthritis. It was a well-rounded practice, a well-rounded yoga practice that included awareness and focus exercises. Chanting the sound of Om.
I was really impressed by some of the details you shared about chanting Om as well, because that's something when I practice yoga by myself, sometimes I have this moment of doubt where I'm like, do I really need to say Om? There's nobody else here. And I found your answer interesting.
Yes, actually, I'll get back to that because this particular researcher, Dr. Munaz, taught yoga or taught a meditation to Congress and had them sneakily chant Om. So I'd like to circle back around to that. So the entire practice that she taught for arthritis had all these elements like Om that are required. Like I teach this as a teacher training. People can come as yoga teachers and learn how to teach this evidence-based program yoga for arthritis. And a lot of teachers come and they think they're going to learn some magical sequence. But instead, they get a basic hatha, which is that basic style of yoga class, and they get philosophy that's pulled from the rich tradition of yoga that's integrated through the class that makes it really rich and specific to arthritis and chronic pain and dealing with pain and all the things that come with arthritis. That's what the real magic, the essence of that practice is. And you have to teach a well-rounded yoga class in order to have this evidence-based program. Like, you can't just go in and take those elements out and not chant Om and not incorporate the philosophy. Then it's not yoga for arthritis based off of a 7-year clinical trial. And a lot of yoga researchers are doing that. When you look at their actual protocols, it is a well-rounded practice that includes a lot of traditional elements. So back to the sound of Om and why that's important. Well, we know that singing and verbalizing has great benefits for your health. If you do sing in the shower, you know that it makes you feel good. But also in the modern day, we know that it stimulates the vagus nerve, which is a nerve that is coming off from the base of the brain. And it's the only one that goes to other areas of the body. It goes to your heart and your gut, and it's connecting your mind and the vital organs of your body. So it is responsible, in essence, for that mind-body connection, or greatly responsible for it. And when you chant, the vibrations are stimulating that nerve, which puts you in the rest, digest, and rejuvenate state of your nervous system, that parasympathetic nervous system state, that place where you're healing at the highest capacity, all your organs are functioning at their optimal level. In that place, your heart rate slows, your blood pressure goes down, your digestion improves. So chanting the sound Om is doing that. And according to yogic tradition, the sound of Om specifically is sacred. It has these three parts that represent a sense of beginning, middle, and end, a sense of life and connection. I mean, they say that before the universe, before the Big Bang, there was only the sound of Om, and that's where we all came from, right? That's the mythology, the tradition. Well, what I find interesting in the research, of course, this is like a small trial. Not many people have money to research something so esoteric as this, but they compared people chanting the sound of Om versus people just going,
oh, making a sound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the sound of Om changed their brain waves more into that relaxed state of alpha, when the sound of S didn't. The sound of Om had more going into the parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and digest, than the sound of S. So maybe the yogis were onto something. Whether or not you want to believe the mythology, of the beautiful mythology of before the Big Bang, there was only the sound of Om, or not, the sound of Om does have physiological benefits, and it feels good to do it. So back to that researcher, Dr. Munoz, who did the Yoga for Arthritis trial. She was asked to teach meditation, a meditation like to open an event for Congress. And she asked them if she could chant Om. And she was told no. So she's a little bit of a rebel. Actually, I'd like you to do this with me, what she did. She didn't ask permission to do this. She just went on the stage and she said, okay, everybody, we're going to sigh together. So Robert, you can do it with me. Okay. If you're at home, you can try it out with me, because you're going to get the same benefit. So notice your breath. Notice your posture. We'll do three sighs together. Repeat after me.
Ah. Ah.
Oh.
Oh.
Mm. So basically, she tricked Congress into Oming.
That's beautiful. I love the idea of getting, you know, everyone in Congress to sort of have their neurons fire on the same wavelength for once, for at least for a moment there.
Absolutely.
All right. Looks like it's time for a break, but we'll be right back with more of this interview.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC, We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, listener. I'm Carol Fisher, the host of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister. I'm so excited for you to hear the brand new season where we're uncovering a 35-year-old mystery. But for those of you who didn't hear season one or just want to listen to it again, you can now get access to all episodes of that first season of The Girlfriends 100% ad-free through the iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, which is available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. You'll also get access to every single episode of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, ad-free and 1 week early, only available to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. So what are you waiting for? Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we return.
So you touched a little bit on this already, but I wanted to ask you about something you discuss in the book here, and that's mirror neurons. Because one of the things that I often find with yoga is that, you know, I can do yoga on my own and have sort of a standard routine, probably too standard, that I fall into, and then I can do a video and get a little more out of it. But you know, there's nothing like going to a class, and a large part of that is, like, I feel it's following somebody's instruction. It's doing what they tell me to do, doing what they show me, and then also sort of looking around and seeing what other people are doing, and you know, when I need reminders about which arm is in the air and which one's on the floor, etc. But you mentioned mirror neurons as being a key to what's going on here.
Yeah, I think actually there's several components I'd like to mention. Mirror neurons being one of them. You know, you are connecting with what the teacher is doing, and you're physically moving your arm in a similar way, and you're thinking that out. But you're also probably connecting with your teacher's compassion or present moment awareness, and same with the people present with you in the room, the people next to you. So that absolutely is a contributing factor to those group classes. But also, I would say that there's something quite special or magical about a group setting. We are herd animals. We are social creatures, and isolation is the new smoking. Mm-hmm. So to come into a group of people and to practice something that's healthy and positive and connect with people is really profound for our health.
And I want to come back to something that you mentioned earlier, and this is something that a claim about yoga or just something you hear about yoga a lot that always kind of raised my doubts. And that was the idea that you have like emotions stored in your body and then they're released during yoga. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, like I've had experiences during yoga where this felt very true, where I'll suddenly have some sort of, negative emotion that seems to sort of be released from inside me, or maybe I end up even tearing up during the practice. So where do you stand on this idea of emotional release during yogic practice?
Well, it's undeniable. Like you said, if you practice yoga for a certain amount of time, eventually you'll feel something like this. And like that Ayurvedic saying, which is that Indian medical system, Ayurveda, is, I mentioned earlier, the issues are stored in the tissues. So I'm also a licensed massage therapist, and I see this all the time. People will cry or even laugh when you release a muscle. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's even more powerful when somebody can do that for themselves. So you're on your island of a yoga mat, and I, as a teacher or yoga therapist, am just guiding you through that awareness and movement. So I am teaching you how to release those stored emotions that maybe have been ignored. And when you release that there's a relief of letting go of that tension that's held in your body, but also there is a psycho-emotional release that may help you live to your fullest. And that's really what I want to do, is like empower people to learn how to use these practices so they can do that for themselves. They don't have to come to me or go get a massage. They now have the tools to be able to do this for themselves. And that brings me to something that I think is interesting to explain from both a spiritual and a scientific perspective, is that concept of prana. So prana is vital energy or life force. You may have heard it as qi in Chinese tradition and different Asian philosophies and native philosophies. There's this like vital energy that makes us us and that surrounds us and connects us, a life force. Well, as I was studying the pre-med course load and doing physics and anatomy and physiology, it started to conceptualize prana as maybe something that ancient yogis who like devoted their whole life to this practice, observing their bodies, feeling it, observing, writing these observations down, they were basically feeling the physiology and the physics of their own body. So there's these different types of energy that we have in our body. And perhaps prana is all of those put together. Now, this is just like my theory. Maybe it'll change in time, but this is how I feel about it. So we have these emotional charges. We have these held emotional energies in our body, and they change. They evolve and turn into electrical energy, right, through our nervous network, this eloquent electric language that we have within us. So that now it's in our nervous system. And how our brains fire and how our muscles are connected to our nerves and maybe how they hold tension. And then there's also this mechanical energy in us. We have these vibrating cells within us that are all communicating through our body, and they are affected by our lifestyle changes. So yoga affects your biochemistry, changes the way your cells release chemicals, the way your brain releases chemicals. And then there's this like sense of potential energy within us that is released from kinetic energy, from movement, from the poses or asanas. And we feel this flowing energy, the blood and the fluid circulating in our body. So maybe prana is all of this, all these types of energy that I learned about in physics class. Maybe the ancient yogis were just feeling it and put a word to it and called it vital life force energy.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because obviously, sometimes we think about people in the ancient past, and we have we have a reluctance to attribute, like, you know, really modern consciousness to them, and to realize that they would have, you know, that they're obviously capable of having, you know, very deep thoughts and insights into say what the body is doing, even if they don't have certainly the modern terminology or the, you know, the English language terminology for what's going on. I like how you emphasize Hans Selye's 1936 concept of not only stress but eustress. Can you explain the distinction and how it factors into yoga?
Yeah, we think stress is bad. Let me get rid of stress, right? But I will tell you, although I do believe in the power of yoga, it will not get rid of your stress. What it will do is help change how you perceive, experience, and deal with stress so that you can deal with stress with a better attitude and more resilience. So Hans Selye coined the term stress in 1936, and he described that as the body's response to change. So not necessarily a bad thing as we talk about it in the modern day. Now there's two different types of stress. There's eustress, like the word euphoria, that same thing, root word. It's like a good stress. And then there's distress. That's what we think of in the modern day, right? As that bad stress. Or I don't even necessarily want to say bad stress. It's like a real or imagined stress that puts pressure on your system, that weighs down your system and puts this greater load on it, that makes your organs work harder, that degrades your brain tissue, that ultimately leads to these lifestyle diseases, like heart disease and diabetes and arthritis, these things that start to affect, not just start to, that are deeply affecting our society. So I say that yoga can help you deal with that distress better and not have as much imagined distress. So it's real or imagined stressors, right?
Like the paper tigers of our lives,
yeah,
right?
Right. Like we feel like we're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger and we have the same physiological stress response as if we are when we're about to go into a meeting. And instead, it's probably going to be fine. Your life is not in danger. You do not need to release the same level of cortisol or stress hormones or adrenaline. Yes, throughout the day, not to criminalize adrenaline or stress hormones, because throughout the day, those go up and down and we need to have them. We don't want to be stress-free. We actually need to have stress to rise to the occasion. So instead, when I'm about to go into a meeting or I'm about to do a talk, maybe I can observe my heart beating and my sweat as an indicator that this is something that's important to me. Now, can I use my tools of yoga to clear my mind, to breathe deeply, make sure I'm getting the proper breath for the awareness that I need in the moment? Kelly McGonigal, a researcher, talks about this, that you can observe that stress response as a good thing, as your body rising to the occasion to be able to handle that stress. So I think that yoga and the mindset shift from yoga is that, oh, I can deal with this stress. Now I have tools to not get into a spiraling down anxiety in this stressful state. Instead, I can observe it and say, okay, this is hard, but like this could be turned into a good type of stress, or maybe I can minimize those imagined stresses here in the moment through awareness, through mindfulness, through deep breathing, or a pose that helps me feel more connected and aware.
So in discussing the mind and our, you know, and also our perceptions of stress and so forth, the brain itself, can yoga change the brain?
Yes, it sure does. The electrical activity in our brains changes, like in the moment when you are meditating or when you're doing a mindful practice like yoga, like movement with awareness. So you go from that alert state where your mind is constantly balancing around that beta brainwaves to more alpha brainwaves, which is that relaxed state of the mind where it's like you're about to fall asleep. Yeah, the mind wanders a little here and there, but it's lesser so. And then sometimes meditative practices can even put us in a different electrical state, the theta waves, which are associated with creativity. And this is something really common in kids. They have a lot of theta waves, but adults don't as much. But meditators can go into that creative space more. Beyond that, yoga in the short term and in the long term affects what parts of your brains are firing. So in the short term, we can look and see that the areas of your brain through these awareness practices that are firing are, for example, your prefrontal cortex that has to do with, that's that essence that makes us us as humans. It helps us plan and evaluate and regulate our emotions. And that area increases with a lot of these practices because we're focused. And over a long term, that area becomes measurably thicker. Like we can look at it in a scanner and see that you have more brain tissue because you have more connections in that area. And to maintain the brain connections in our prefrontal cortex is huge because as we age, there's a natural degradation that occurs with age. But if we can maintain that, then we are basically like Sarah Lazar's researcher, she's a Harvard researcher, and she shows that 50-year-old meditators have key brain structures similar to that of 25-year-old non-meditators.
Oh, wow.
So this suggests, yeah, that meditation may slow or even prevent some of the natural degradation of brain tissue that happens with aging. So that is pretty huge. Some other areas of your brain are downregulated. So areas like your fear center is downregulated. And then your memory area, your hippocampus, builds more connections. So you have more of a sense of being able to recall things from the far past, but more of a working memory, I think, is what's really important to a lot of people. That improves through these meditative practices, so through yoga and through meditation. All of these changes are pretty profound. I don't know. I also like the biochemical effects because we are seeing changes in the chemistry of your brain. There is a type of neurotransmitter called GABA that is basically something that counteracts anxiety and stress symptoms. So when we are depressed or anxious, a lot of the medications actually are increasing our GABA levels. They're affecting those. Well, meditation does that and yoga does that on its own. It increases GABA, which means that you are more relaxed and you have less of those stress and anxiety sort of symptoms. Also serotonin, one that we've all heard of that medications affect for depression and anxiety. Well, that goes up from meditation and yoga. And dopamine is a reward chemical that's regulated. That's regulated through yoga and meditation. And then cortisol overall is reduced, that stress hormone. And norepinephrine, or the adrenaline, basically, is reduced overall from yoga and meditation. So all of these chemicals change. That's pretty awesome. I mean, that's what the pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know, is that you can do a lot of this on your own. And I'm not suggesting that we should not take medications when needed. There's a lot of conditions that absolutely need it, or times in your life where you may need it in order to get out of that funk. But yoga is being shown through the research to be an excellent adjunct therapy, to be used alongside whatever your medical team and you decide is appropriate for you, because it has these same brain chemistry changes.
I know I want to go back to discussions of the yoga community and spiritualism and science, and sometimes the sort of butting of heads between the two. In 2012, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times science writer William J. Broad's book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and Rewards, came out. And I thought it was a very illuminating book. I read it when it came out, and I appreciated the attention to historic and scientific detail. But he also caught some criticism from some in the yoga community due, I think, in large part to discussions of injuries and really the risk portion of that subtitle. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, I agree that the historical aspects of the book were really fascinating. It drew me in. But it's funny, I was actually at a conference soon after that book came out. I was at the Symposium of Yoga Research at Kripalu. So that's where all the yoga researchers in the world get together and nerd out about the recent yoga research. And some of the researchers who were interviewed in his book or whose research was referred to in his book definitely felt misconstrued. The yoga community, whether it be the mainstream yoga community or also the yoga research community, felt misconstrued. And I would say the reason being is that yoga researchers tend to be quite conservative in their claims and reasonable. And this book is an editorial book versus mine, which is like a reference book and an educational resource. So in this editorial style often comes some sensationalizing, which I won't lie. It really makes it interesting and it makes it a New York Times bestseller. So he actually put out an article in the New York Times right when the book was released called How Yoga Will Wreck Your Body. And he does practice yoga, so he's not saying yoga is actually bad, but that sort of villainization or that sensationalizing, I don't think is overall helpful for getting yoga to the masses. So I think that that is part of it. I mean, there's a systematic review on the safety of yoga. That a review is when there's enough research that we can look at it and be like, okay, here's what all of that research says. And it shows that yoga is as safe, if not safer, than other forms of exercise. And I would argue it's safer because we have that sense of present moment awareness and the philosophy of not harming yourself. So that's one aspect of it. It's just kind of sensationalizing any harm that could happen from yoga. There are some injuries with yoga. And I think it's important that yoga teachers know ways to be safer. And I have some things that you can, as a practitioner or a teacher, be able to understand the safety in my book, Science of Yoga, compared to The Science of Yoga. They get confused a lot. But in my book, I talk about that because I think it is important. However, the number of injuries is pretty darn low when we look at how much yoga is practiced. It is overall a really safe practice. And he was also pretty critical of yoga therapy, which is my field, and it is an emerging field, but now we have a clear scope of practice. And Veterans Affairs hospitals, VA hospitals, are hiring full-time yoga therapists due to their success and the research on PTSD and chronic pain, two issues that veterans really can benefit from. So there is a shift happening towards integrative and preventative health care, and the International Association of Yoga Therapists has a seat at the table. So since Broad has written that book, things have changed rapidly, and they are continuing to change as more and more research comes out.
Now, on the topic of risks, you do have a section in your book about cautions, and that I found very insightful. Because I think back to times where, you know, only a couple of really mainly one or two times where I've had some sort of minor, injury, I guess, from yoga. It's generally from times where I was overzealous and I wasn't really approaching it with the right mindset where I'm like, oh, I've got to have that bind. Like that bind looks so great. I feel like if I could just connect my hands in this particular pose, I'll be so happy. And then, of course, I pull something because my body is not ready to do that. That seems to be a part of the scenario, right? That we should just knowing what to do and what not to do for our bodies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I work with a lot of people one-on-one because as a yoga therapist, I am working with more of the at-risk populations, people with joint replacements, chronic pain, severe arthritis, back issues. And so I would suggest to people to, if you feel like you're not sure, to get a one-on-one teacher or a yoga therapist. But if you feel like you can go to a group class, don't compare yourself to other people in the room. Try to make sure that you are on your little island of a yoga mat and you are doing what is right for you. You're not harming yourself. I think that that is really important. There are some key things you can do to not get hurt. And I like to outline those things, and I teach teachers those things because I think it is important. But I also don't want to sensationalize that aspect of yoga, because overall, yoga is safe. Just don't push yourself too hard.
Now, you already touched on at least one yoga myth, and like I say, in the book, you do bust some myths here and there. You mentioned the kidneys already. Do you have another great example that you feel comes up a bit too often?
Yeah, I hear in yoga classes sometimes it's said, we're doing this twist to help you wring out the toxins. Or they describe a yoga class as like detoxifying after Thanksgiving or a night of drinking. And I do not think that you were wringing out your toxins by twisting. I think also that I don't like the philosophy of considering myself toxic. My body is able to deal with toxins efficiently through the liver, filtering them. And by movement, I'm not stimulating my liver, not as far as we know. Like, a liver is not an organ that works by like squeezing it. Like, that's not what encourages this function. However, the digestive organs are. They work by movement and squeezing them that helps that process of peristalsis, or the movement of food through the digestive tract, through your bowels. So instead, I might replace that when we're twisting as, you are encouraging good digestion and a flow to have good proper elimination. You're encouraging that peristalsis. That is a true benefit. But I don't know if I buy that you are wringing out the toxin. Nor do I buy that you are toxic and you need to do something about it. I think you are whole and perfect just as you are. You do not need to detoxify yourself. And that is the philosophy of yoga, is recognizing that wholeness. Your body does that naturally. So I think it's just best to focus on what's actually happening. And what's actually happening is pretty darn cool, so why not?
So for anyone out there who has heard this interview and they're like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to finally try yoga. And they're going to go out somewhere and try it for the first time. What advice do you have for them?
Don't feel like you need to be flexible or have a certain body type. Most of the yoga research is on the profound benefits for older adults and people with chronic diseases. Like, anybody can do this. That's what the research is showing. So it's not about, you know, being able to put your feet behind your ears. Like, the research, if anything, it shows that it's about what's in between your ears that is most profoundly affected. So I would say just try it. Take a 10-minute break of yoga at work and do something in your chair. I have some free videos on my website, AnnSwansonWellness.com. You can do these things right at work. Do yoga breaks. So instead of going on a smoking break, take a yoga break. You're going to have even more benefits from doing small practices throughout the day rather than a full 60-minute practice if that feels overwhelming to you. So actually, you're going to get more from it if you can take a 5-minute meditation here or 2-minute meditation there. So I would say try it. If you don't like a specific class, try another. Maybe get a one-on-one teacher so that you can adapt it for your body. And feel like you can do small things, because the small things make a big difference.
All right, looks like it is time for a quick break, but we will be right back with more.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Now, of course, when someone tries out yoga for the first time or the second time, the third time, as they try different options, you know, they're going to encounter those, that intersection of science and spiritualism, which again is I think one of the most fascinating things going on with yoga. Yeah, I'm of the mind that that both are important. The science has to be our skeptical bedrock, but the spiritual modes of thinking can greatly improve the human condition. How do you integrate the two in your practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to emphasize that science and spirituality do not have to be mutually exclusive. So, like I said, I am a total hashtag science nerd, hashtag spiritual nerd, get my millennial side in there. I work with people with chronic pain, anxiety, and sleep issues because yoga therapy is so well suited for these multifaceted, complex lifestyle conditions. And it's that spiritual component that I think really does serve people. So it's not only does the scientific research suggest, but that these practices have benefits, but also that they're life changing. And that's what people tell me. And that's my experience myself. People say to me, this simple practice that you gave me, it literally changed my life. And when somebody says life changing to me, that represents a spiritual shift. But you may not be comfortable with the word spiritual, and that's cool. Like, you can replace it. I mean, I'm embracing it, but you can replace it to a mindset shift or a life of more purpose and meaning. That's what I think yoga provides us or can provide us. And one of my favorite quotes is by Einstein, if I can read that. He says that a human being is a part of a whole called by us as universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, to me, that's what yoga helps me realize is that interconnectedness, that union. And I think that it can be both science-based and have research to support it and have that spiritual component, that deeper sense of connection simultaneously.
Well, we talked about this before we went on the air here, if you will. You gave us this example of the fake meditation, the fake mindfulness exercise earlier. We're going to see if you can close out here for us with an example of an actual mindfulness exercise that our listeners can also participate in.
Absolutely. And you remember me mentioning earlier that the sound of Om stimulates the vagus nerve and puts you in that rest and digest state. Well, the ancient yogis also intuited that elongating your exhales puts you into that relaxed state. And it actually does. It stimulates your vagus nerve also. So you can go into a deeper relaxation state quicker if you elongate your exhales. I think it's pretty cool they intuited that. And now we have a name for it, respiratory sinus arrhythmia. Like, not that you need to know the name, but that we have an actual name for it in the modern scientific day. So let's practice it for ourselves. If you're like driving around the world, you can have your eyes open and continue on your day doing this. Or if you are comfortable at home, you're welcome to sit or stand tall and pause for a moment, maybe even close your eyes if that's comfortable. Notice your natural breath to begin. Now I'd like you to bring your breath down. What I mean by that is allow your belly to move more with your breath, to expand with the inhales and release down and in with the exhales. You may even want to put your hands on your belly to feel and allow that. Begin to elongate your exhales, trying to let as much of the breath out with each exhale without forcing. You may be deepening your breath. That's good. Maybe even listen to your breath as you do this. You may hear all the sounds around you in whatever environment you're in. But focus on your breath in the foreground, feeling it, sensing it, hearing it, as you elongate your exhales for 5 more deep breaths. Finishing off these breaths, as you finish them, notice how your body feels, the state of your mind from just a minute or two of awareness and simply elongating your exhales. If your eyes are closed, you can gently open them. Thank you so much, Robert, for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you for joining us and discussing yoga and discussing your book.
Absolutely. And if people are interested in the research, I have a reference guide on my website, scienceof.yoga. And you can download it and click right to these research studies. So if you're interested in not only my book, The Simple Ways, but being able to dive in and see for yourself as you ask why, I have those guides on www.scienceof.yoga.
Excellent. All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. So there you have it. Again, the book is Science of Yoga, Understand the Anatomy and Physiology to Perfect Your Practice. It came out this year in 2019, and it's available, I think, in pretty much all formats and in different languages. Again, it's a gorgeous book. The layout and illustration and the content itself is fabulous. And you can check out Anne's website at anneswansonwellness.com. And if you want more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find our show. If you want to check out Invention, you'll find that at inventionpod.com. And you'll also just find the show wherever you get podcasts these days, and wherever that may happen to be, sprinkle a few stars our way. Leave a nice review. That really helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.